So, folks, this is Cut Jib Newsletter, the podcast. Unfortunately, without the dulcet tones of J.J. Sefton, who is in the process of moving to America from the deepest depths of communist New York City to a hopefully Republican state, Wisconsin. So luckily we have a gentleman here who is going to tell us everything that is going to happen in the next 2 years in terms of elections and polling and such, the estimable Dave in Florida.
Oh, hey, how are you doing?
Doing great. How are you doing?
I am doing fine. I'm sorry I'm not JJ. You know, we are both going to miss him here today.
Well, I
do want to say, though, I feel relatively confident. I mean, jury's still out, but I'm relatively confident that he will definitely be in a Republican state, a red state, by the time he gets there. The trend is very strong in Wisconsin for him to do that.
Well, let's talk about that. That's a great place to start. How about a discussion about the tone in the country and the possibility of a majority, a Republican majority, both in the House of Representatives and in the Senate?
Well, interestingly enough, today I've been listening to your podcast from last Friday with you and JJ and Joe, and you guys did a terrific job. You know, want to be absolutely clear about that. You guys really did touch on an odd dichotomy that we're dealing with in this country. And you hear this all the time. You know, I read it all the time on the board. It's like, yeah, we're going to have elections. Yeah, there's going to be a red wave. Yeah, we're going to win. And will it matter? And that's where the jury is out. I can give you a decent idea of where the mood of the voters are right now. And what's going to very likely to happen in the upcoming elections, both in 22 and in 24. But, you know, as you saw after the decisions were handed down by the Supreme Court, you know, what the left does in response to that or in preparation for it is kind of, you know, you just don't know. I mean, it's just kind of stunning that the New York legislature turns around and immediately just gives a big finger to the Supreme Court by saying, OK, fine, you're telling us that that we have to be shall issue. Fine, we'll be shall issue and make it illegal to be anywhere other than on public roads and public sidewalks with a firearm. So what actually happens is hard to know, but I can give you a good idea of where the mood of the voters are right now. Sound like you had something to say there.
Well, yeah, believe it or not, I was surprised by the politicians in New York that they gave a big fat middle finger to the United States Supreme Court, but also to about 45% of their electorate. The only reason why New York City, why New York State is a Democrat state is because of New York City, a couple of counties around in and around Buffalo, maybe Albany and Syracuse, the little college towns that pepper New York are, you know, maybe have 50,000 votes total. But I was surprised at how brazen they were in rejecting, in ignoring a clear decision on the part of the Supreme Court. Obviously, this will go back to the courts, and I think that it will be slapped down very, very quickly.
I think so, too. I think in probably a month or two, at the minimum, the Second Circuit is going to issue either a summary judgment or at a minimum, they're going to put an injunction against the law, this new law. So the circuit court, the appellate courts have been able to get away with kind of being wishy-washy on this because they had a claim about Heller and what it actually meant. But with the Supreme Court being very clear about this is what we mean by Heller, and you can't just go half measures, it's going to be very difficult for the appellate courts to make it come to any other decision. But anyway, that's not the question you had. Where are the voters? Very interesting poll people were talking about today from Monmouth showing, you know, right track, wrong track. And I wrote about this, I think, 2 weeks ago. And, you know, the numbers from May have just gotten worse. You know, we're at a point now where 90% of the electorate believes we're on the wrong track. You know, that's a number that's unheard of. I mean, you know, I think the worst I can ever remember is something like a 75% wrong track number. I've never heard of 90% of the electorate thinking we're going in the wrong direction. And
10% is retarded.
Yeah. I kind of wonder about that 10% that think we're heading in the right direction. Now, to be fair, there is a number of those newly wrong track people that are exercised about Roe v. Wade. Yeah, they're saying, hey, we're in the wrong track because Supreme Court is overturning 50 years of precedent. So that's part of the hardening of it. But it comes down to, you know, no matter where you stand on any of the issues, the 90% of the electorate is in a partisan divide where they believe what they believe and they are not going to see eye to eye with the other side. Now, the vast majority of those are clearly on, quote unquote, the right, you know, in terms of wanting to see, you know, lower gasoline prices, lower food prices, not wanting to be in an economic recession or depression or what have you, and wanting to see politics, not necessarily politics as usual, but politics as expected. You know, every 2 years we have an election and the will of the people is heard and followed by those politicians. So the vast majority of the electorate right now wants a return to normal, and they're not getting it, not out of this administration and not out of the Democrats.
So granting them that normal is some semblance of sanity, what do you see as the trend in the United States in the next, four months or 3 months plus until the election? Because, you know, I just noticed on Real Clear Politics, the polling data out of Georgia, which is now again, it's a single poll, but I'm looking at, you know, Walker plus three, Walker plus four, Warnock plus five. And then all of a sudden, 2 weeks ago or less than 2 weeks ago, Warnock plus 10 out of Quinnipiac. And the problem is
the Q poll is notoriously bad. So here's the thing about how polling works. OK, you're polling. You have to have a method for doing your polling, and then you have to have a demographic adjustment, and you have to get your poll results from someone, somewhere. And the bottom line is that pollsters can be lazy about it. The most likely person to answer a poll, no matter what your methodology for collecting the information is going to be a liberal Democrat, an urban liberal Democrat. They are the most likely person to respond to a poll, you know, by maybe 10-1. Okay, if you want to get a rural conservative white male from southeastern Pennsylvania, southwestern Pennsylvania, you know, from down in Greene County or something like that, you probably have to poll 20, 30 people before you'll get a single person that fits that demographic. And a lot of pollsters just kind of stop. They say, okay, I've gotten enough people and that's good enough. The problem with the Q poll is in this particular Q poll is they've oversampled Atlanta and they've oversampled Savannah. They have not gotten anything from the southern portions of Georgia to give themselves a demographically correct poll. So I'm very suspicious of that poll. My belief is that what we've got is probably Walker's about ahead, probably about four or five at the moment. And I'm just waiting for other polling firms to provide information.
That's exactly what I wanted to hear, because you know, I look at that race in Georgia, and you know, we have Raphael, however he pronounces his first name, Warnock, who's a machine politician and quite a scary one because he's both dumb and doctrinaire, and we have on the other side Herschel Walker, who is a extraordinarily appealing man without any political experience, but with a significant and coherent political philosophy. And I think that is the future of the Republican Party. People like that. He's probably in his 50s, maybe 60 years old. I really don't know. But the lack of political experience, I think, is going to be a tremendous advantage for him. And again, for the Republican Party and the conservative portion of that party in the future.
That's an interesting point that you're seeing play out in more than just Georgia. What's going on? So if you take a look at the Senate, most likely result this year in 22 is that you're going to have three or four pickups. GOP will end up at probably 53, maybe 54 outside. And the 54 is really kind of dependent on what happens in both Pennsylvania and in New Hampshire. Despite how everybody feels about it, Oz has a good chance of winning that seat in Pennsylvania because of the way Pennsylvania is restructuring itself in terms of the electorate. So there's a good chance that Toomey's seat does not get lost. And then where else you're gonna see pickups? You're gonna see pickups in Arizona. You're gonna see pickup in Nevada, and you'll see that pickup in Georgia. And you possibly could see one in New Hampshire as well. That's very much candidate driven. If Sununu had run for that seat in New Hampshire, it would be a slam dunk. He would be winning that, but he chose not to run. So it's slightly uncertain there. But here's the thing that's really interesting to me. If you count up in terms of GOPE, the establishment Republicans versus kind of the MAGA types, the people that are outsiders, that are populists, that are interested in making a change to the deep state, how the deep state is operating, you actually have more pickups than that. Okay, you have Roy Blunt in Missouri, who's retiring. He's going to be replaced by absolutely Republicans going to win there, and he will be replaced by a MAGA candidate. J.D. Vance is going to win in Ohio. Who's the other one? Oh, North Carolina.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about North Carolina because the real clear politics shows it. Toss up. I don't know. It looks like it's leaning Republican right now.
This year, anybody who's telling you any traditional swing or close state is on the edge or leaning Republican or tied, they're insane. It's not going to happen. The Republican turnout is going to be so over the top this year, and the Democrat turnout is so depressed that's going to, anytime there's anything close, it's just default going to the Republican. An interesting case is going to be in Alaska, though. In my mind, whether or not Murkowski wins is she kind of did herself a disservice. She's tried to fix the election to make sure she would get on to. I consider her to be the one that did it, even though it was a popular referendum to do this jungle primary that they're doing. But she's in a situation where she's going to be on the ballot for the general election and most likely against her top opponent. I can't she has an odd name that I can't remember, but she has
LC Gray Jackson. Is that it? Is that, or that's the Democrat?
No. There's begins with a T anyway.
Shibaka.
Yeah. She has Trump's endorsement, and I'm not convinced she's going to win the general or that Murkowski will win the general.
Interesting, because that would be a profound slapdown of the GOPE.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, that would be wonderful.
And it's kind of, in my opinion, it's kind of an own goal. I think Murkowski would win the primary, but I think simply because of turnout and the fact that they've moved Alaska to vote by mail. Mm. But I don't think she can get away with that level of cheating in the general that she could get away with in the primary. So it's entirely possible that she'll make it to the general. Will have poisoned the well so badly by then that she doesn't survive. So it'll be interesting to see. But the bottom line is, the Mitch McConnell wing is going to lose between seven or eight seats. And you know, in this election in the Senate. You know,
let's use that point to as a segue to the larger point, which is the future prospects of America. If Mitch McConnell remains in power, Mitch McConnell, I'll use him as a placeholder for everything that we find reprehensible about the Republican Party and the conservative movement in America. But if he is no longer in a position of power, if the Trump wing of the Republican / conservative party begins an ascent into power that perhaps could last a generation, what are the prospects for America? Because as you mentioned last week, we had three people on, you know, Sefton, me, and Joe Mannix, who were quite pessimistic about the future prospects of America.
And I get it. I get how you feel about it. I'm probably more optimistic, but I can't disagree with what you're saying. I certainly see all of the scenarios that are playing out in your heads as being possible scenarios. However, I do look at it from a historic perspective. We as a country have gone through this type of situation five or six times, and we've managed to make our way through it. The first kind of revolution was back with Andrew Jackson, and that led to take the slavery part out of the conversation, but it did lead to a American revitalization for a generation. Saw the same reaction to Wilson. Ironically, the response to Wilson only lasted about 10 years because the Republicans that came in then they started moving to the deep state trough. Which resulted in FDR as a result. And whether or not you agree with FDR, he did have a governing philosophy that was accepted and by the majority of the population. And you know, you can't really argue with the fact that that was how the country wanted to be governed at that time, and he had the popular majority for it. So you end up in these situations where government is moving in a direction opposite of the way where the population wants to go. And that always comes to some form of a crisis. And to date, the voters have always had the final, have always had the final.
Okay, we're going to take a break because we seem to have lost Dave in Florida. I will call him back and we will return anon. Future prospects of America, a lighthearted topic. So one of the things that you were talking about how the electorate eventually gets what they desire, and that the Roosevelt top-down budding welfare state was in fact what America wanted. But that was also the beginning of the entrenchment of the deep state in American politics and in American governance. And I think we've reached its culmination in the last few years. There's nowhere else to go because it can't be any more onerous and it can't be any more profound control over our government.
Remain a constitutional republic.
Yes, exactly. And that's the issue. Can a conservative resurgence over the next generation, can it push back sufficiently hard against that deep state, against the uniparty that is so powerful in both federal government and increasingly in some of the blue states? Can it push back hard enough? Can it restrict their behavior to such an extent that we return to some semblance of a constitutional republic?
So, going back to what Mannix said last week, you can see ways of pushing back through nullification. You know, you can have nullification, either states nullifying federal government, or you can have citizens nullifying state government. Actually, this new gun law in New York is interesting to me in two ways. First of all, let's assume that what's almost certainly going to happen is that the Supreme Court is going to overrule that. Okay, so what happens next? State, you know, how hard does New York keep pushing back on that? And then how hard do the citizens of New York push back on the state? If the Supreme Court has said, well, no, that law is not constitutional and doesn't exist, well, citizens can, at that point, what stops them from, you know, open carry or concealed carry? If they're arrested, what are they arrested for? You know, any, at that point, cases start going through the judicial system, and the federal judiciary says, nope, sorry, it's not illegal, you know, so you cannot arrest these people. Okay. And then the other side is, I think a lot of red states are probably paying a lot of attention. If a blue state pushes back against the Supreme Court and has any amount of success in doing so, well, that starts setting a model for other states to nullify laws they don't like. What happens when Florida then pushes back and said, yeah, those EPA regulations, we don't agree with those either. So we're just going to ignore them. Taxation? Nah, we don't think we're going to bother collecting taxes for the federal government. And we'll just collect it for the state government. We'll hold it in escrow. And when you finally get your act together, maybe we'll send you money from Florida. There's a lot of interesting constitutional questions when you just throw out the whole respect for the authority of the Supreme Court.
That's a lovely, lovely way of looking at it, because there's always the other side of the coin. You know, I was thinking about Texas and the need for new refineries in Texas. And I wondered what would happen if the state of Texas said, well, you know something, we're going to grant them a state construction permit. And what are you going to do about it, EPA? Where is your army to stop the construction of this new mega refinery that's going to streamline the logistics of petroleum distillation in America? And the answer is, it will probably cause a constitutional crisis of some sort or another. But since the Supreme Court has already held that the EPA has overstepped its bounds and that its claimed control over essentially everything in the United States is invalid, it would be quite interesting and fun as hell. I mean, I have to admit part of this is the simple joy of watching Washington lose its power.
You know, I made a joke a while ago that the best thing we could do is just put a wall around Washington and throw money inside. I mean, just take whatever we're spending, you know, sending to Washington now, fine, give them the money. And just do whatever you want inside that wall. We just don't care, and let the rest of the country deal with it. You know, we'll handle the rest of our affairs, because we don't actually need you.
It sounds lovely, doesn't it?
Yeah,
and, you know,
it does.
And when last week on the podcast, we had three very pessimistic people, but in my small decreasing optimism about America, I see things that are just so wonderful about this glorious, glorious nation. And I try to convince myself that this is a blip, that we will return to the principles that drove us for more than 200 years. And I see flashes of it in, you know, the bottom up pushback against Washington. You read about local elections where they dumped all six Democrats on the village council and brought in some constitutional conservatives, things like that, or school districts that dump the lunatics and bring back actual learning for their children. And as you say, eventually the electorate will get what it wants. The real question, I guess, is does the electorate still want a constitution-driven country?
I think you're might be asking the wrong question there.
That doesn't surprise me.
Well, does the country want a constitution-driven country? That, you know, the Constitution is the mechanism whereby the population gets the liberty. This is July 5th, July 4th, 1776, you know, endowed by our Creator, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Constitution's the mechanism for getting there. It's a structure. And the structure doesn't always work, and we have a process for changing that structure, either through the amendment process or, God help us, if they actually go to a constitutional convention, because I hate to think what would happen out of that. But the structure provides the guidelines on how we're supposed to order our affairs in order for the population to get their God-given rights, for right to liberty. Okay, and the population does want that. Do they necessarily care if it's a constitution or some other mechanism? Well, you know, people aren't enough of constitutional scholars and don't have enough civics to understand that. But at the bottom, at the end of the day, they do understand things like, hey, I want to be able to afford gas so I can go to the beach because I want to go to the beach, not because someone tells me it's my day to go to the beach, or I'm allowed to go to this camp in the mountain because that's where that's my vacation spot that has been allotted to me. Ultimately, the people want liberty, and ultimately the people will get liberty as long as we have a structure that allows them to get that. So it's going to be messy. I think you're going to see this at all levels. You're going to see it at the school board elections, where people that were not politically active suddenly become active. And let me tell you, I've had the opportunity to talk to some teachers since then, and they are just completely freaked out about the fact that people who are not in the education community are winning school board seats. They firmly believe that those people have no business being on a school board, that they don't understand, you know, how to run schools. You see it at the state levels. You see it at the pushback at the state levels. You know, both at the red and red states and blue states. Okay, and then you're also going to see it in 22 and in 24, with the voters turning out and electing Republicans. And some of those Republicans will be good, and a lot of them won't be good. A lot of them will be deep state actors. And you know, the question is, well, what changes can happen in Washington? You know, 24, let's go on the assumption, 24, Trump wins his third election. And what can he do? Well, hopefully he'll be a little bit smarter about personnel. But most of the government, most of the leadership in the government is a political appointee. What happens if Trump decides to not appoint any political appointees? What happens at that point? I mean, there's plenty of opportunity for people getting into Washington to throw a lot of monkey wrenches into how things are done there. And, you know, the deep state ran pretty flawlessly when it was in secret. Now that it's in the open and people don't like it, there's a lot of opportunity to make life very difficult for those people.
I have a little bit of a personal anecdote. Several years ago, I met a gentleman at my wife's, one of her college reunions, and he was an accomplished lawyer at the federal level, and quite a conservative. He and I would chat for hours about the usual things that conservatives chat about. And I saw him at the next reunion, and he told me that he had taken a job in the Trump administration, a high-level legal position within one of the departments. I forgot which one, but the essentially controlling personnel within the federal government. I forgot the name of it. Mm-hmm. And he was gung-ho and was excited. And after a year, he quit because he said that it was unlike anything he had ever seen, that the deep state was far, far more dug in than even he had expected. And he would have frank conversations with these people, and they would look at him and say, you can do what you want, but you're going to leave and I'm going to still be here. And there's nothing you can do about that.
Yeah, that is true.
Yeah.
I mean, they are cockroaches, you know, but the one thing that can be done is cut the money off. Okay. At the end of the day, these people have to get paid. And if they don't give if they don't get paid, they don't work. You know. And the other thing that can be done, I mean, if you want to talk about a long project to, you know, to eliminate the deep state, I mean, these people eventually retire. You don't have to replace them.
But they the problem with that is that they hire like-minded people.
Well, you do not hire anybody without a without a requisition, and
okay.
You can't do the requisition without an appropriation.
Does the president still retain the power to control the purse strings to that extent? I remember reading a few months ago about a bill that Congress passed in the mid 1970s that really hamstrung the president when it came to dealing with unallocated and unspent funds. Do you recall anything like that? I can't offhand remember the.
Yeah, the appropriation situation is a little bit odd. There are multiple colors of money. You do have congressional set asides where Congress says we are allocating this amount of money to your agency that must be spent on this specifically. Okay, vast majority of the appropriations are within some guidelines. But if the agency does not spend that money, then the money returns to the Treasury. Now, obviously, those agencies try really hard to spend all of that money because they risk losing budget the next year if they haven't spent their money. There is no incentive for not spending their appropriation. But if the money isn't appropriated, and you can make the argument that continuing resolutions do not actually appropriate money, then the president may very well be in his right to choose to not spend money and return it to the Treasury. And then personnel is a little bit different. There are some very specific rules and laws associated with the hiring of people into the federal government. I used to be a federal employee, so I've gone through this myself. And it is not absolute that if someone retires from the government, that their position gets filled.
It's very interesting. You've mentioned several things over the past half hour, and each one of them represents a constitutional crisis of some sort or another.
Oh, yeah. and you know, so this is the fire that the Democrats are playing with. By not allowing the people to have their way, that you will, you know, something will happen. I mean, one way or another, you know, the people either will, you know, the people will get what they want. They almost always do. And, you know, it can be either done through regular order, or it can be done through various forms of constitutional crises.
Well, we live in interesting times.
Yeah, fortunately.
Yeah. So
there are
let's
times
take...
I wish we could just go back to when we thought when the masks were on and we thought we had some control over our destiny.
Well, that's what's fascinating about the insinuation of the federal government into all facets of American life. It didn't used to be that way. And I think that's what most people desire, or many, many people desire, to have the federal government be less important in our lives. And that would certainly drive much of the things that I think need to happen in America. If we simply get rid of the federal influence and return to what the 10th Amendment clearly wanted for America.
I actually think the 9th Amendment is the more important one.
Ah, okay. Yes.
all rights go to the individual.
Yes. Yes. Very, very good point. Well, with that, let's take a break, and we will be back in a moment. Okay, so we are back with the last segment of an abbreviated Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks. We are lucky to have Dave in Florida to replace the lack of J.J. Sefton, who is moving on to greener and more free pastures, hopefully. So
I am a poor substitute. I apologize.
I will not say a word. So I think that both of us would like to talk about the 2024 election. And I've made no secret of the fact that I want Ron DeSantis to run, and I do not want Donald Trump to run. I think that Donald Trump is a fantastic leader of the resurgent Republican / conservative party. I think his overweening ego will damage America in the long run. And I think that his drive to revenge his loss in 2020 is coloring everything that he does. I also think that he's just too damned old. We need new blood, and we need young, aggressive, interesting people like Ron DeSantis.
I don't disagree with you. I would, you know, if it was a straight up decision, you know, would I prefer DeSantis to Trump? Yes, I would prefer DeSantis. I think he's a better politician. Now, again, Trump's a better marketer. And one thing to keep in mind, we don't know about DeSantis is we still don't know anything about his philosophy towards foreign policy. You know, he's made no statements where he stands on any foreign policy issues at this point. He has only discussed cultural issues and domestic issues. Now, he's done very good, so we have a feeling about what we think how he would govern, but we haven't heard him make any official statements on that.
I'm going to extrapolate from his comments about Cuba and the lack of freedom in Cuba to a foreign policy that is more respectful of freedom and liberty around the world. Whether that translates to a smart foreign policy is a huge question.
Yeah, but and so the question is how does that translate? Does that translate into a Bush respect or a Trump respect? Okay, where Bush is, there is no freedom loving people that we will not invade in favor of versus. Versus Trump's respect, there is no freedom-loving people that we won't negotiate a tariff deal for. So which philosophy does he embrace? And we just don't know right now. But I'm also a realist. Trump's going to run. Barring a health issue, I can't see him not running. Ironically, I find it amusing that this whole January 6th committee, they seem to be trying to find some way to make Trump disqualified from running for the presidency, and that's just the worst possible situation for them. And a lot of Democrats are telling them that you really do not want to encourage that or find some way to make that happen, because they're really afraid of DeSantis. They think they could beat Trump. They're delusional about that, but they think they could beat Trump, but they don't think they can beat DeSantis.
Well, expand on why they think they can beat Trump and why you think they can't.
Well, because they can't get over their Trump derangement syndrome. They think they've drank their own bathwater. They believe that the entire world hates Trump, and the polling just doesn't support that. Right now, the strongest candidate that the GOP can field, including when you're talking about DeSantis, is Trump. You know, he polls better than any Democrat in a 2024 matchup. Now, interestingly enough, is Susquehanna started taking a look at other candidates that you can put into that the Democrats could field. And of all the candidates the Democrats have, their strongest one is Biden. Every candidate, including Hillary, that you put up against Trump or DeSantis or any other combination loses worse than Biden does. You know, as badly as Biden will get beaten in 24 under current conditions, you know, caveat there, Biden still does better than any of the others.
That's fascinating that he pulls better than Hillary, because she has equal, if not better, name recognition than Joe Biden. So what that tells me, aside from the fact that Democrats are in fact delusional, that there is absolutely no bench, which is something that I've suspected for a couple of years. You know, they're septuagenarians, and they're, oh Christ, even older than that, who run the Democrat Party are, my guess is they're probably 10 or 15 years older than the, their counterparts on the Republican side.
You know who took out their bench, right? It's the Clintons.
That's true. That's
their, their bench was completely decimated by the Clintons to be to put them into a position where they would be the ones running the show here. And then when she lost in 2016, that put them into a very, very bad situation. You know, the only person they could come up with as a consensus candidate was Biden, and he's still their best candidate.
Now, what about the dark horses? You know, people are throwing around Michelle Obama's name, that she was she actually hid from her burning desire to have a political life because it was hurting her husband in the 2008 election. Do you see her on the horizon? Do you have any sense that one, does she want to run, and two, could she run, and three, could she win?
She could win. Yeah, she could win, especially if it's not if she's not up against Trump. She could win. I don't. It's a real odd situation there. I mean, keep in mind, she's a bad politician. She's a real, I mean, you think Kamala Harris is bad? You know, Michelle Obama is just one of the worst possible candidates they could come up with. I mean, if you remember the first time ever being proud of her country statement, I mean, that's the kind of thing that she just naturally comes out. And she gets a lot of glowing press right now, but that's because she doesn't have to actually put forward any policy positions. Okay, once she actually has to state what her policies are, I just don't see the appeal. And she's just not a very likable person, you know, unlike her husband. I mean, I'll say right now that if Obama could run for a third term right now, he would probably beat anybody. You know, there is a very, very strong personal connection that he has with the population that has nothing to do with policy. You know, it is very much a cult of personality with his, in the case of Barack Obama.
And that, of course, people accuse Trump of creating a cult of personality all the time, which I reject out of hand, because I find him personally to be neutral, if maybe even slightly unpleasant. But what I like is what he says and his policies.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I as a person, I don't really care for Trump. I like his policies. You know, I mean, yeah, I'm kind of happy we don't have the mean tweets, but I'd rather, you know, I'd be happy to put up with mean tweets if it meant we get his policies back. I think, you know, the other side is, if you take a look at the Republican bench, I mean, there are, I mean, DeSantis is a great example. The guy's 43 years old. Or yeah. No, is, do I have that right? Is he young? No.
Yeah, he's mid-40s, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, early 40s. Yeah, early 40s, and is clearly presidential material. I mean, I don't think we've had a candidate of his stature. There's been a candidate on the national scene of his stature since JFK, in terms of youth appeal, understands politics, able to appeal to a large swath of people. Now, don't get me wrong, there are a lot of people here in Florida that can't stand DeSantis.
Why?
As well.
Why? Why,
you know, they're the leftists. They, you know, the cultural leftists, and DeSantis is not shy about wading into the cultural fights, and they, you know, they prefer Republicans that are afraid to fight the culture culture wars. Some Republicans that way a whole lot more Democrats than they feel that way, obviously. Of course, they don't like, you know, he's made it. They view him as being the person that has decimated the Democrat Party in Florida for a generation. And they're probably right.
I'm more and more optimistic every minute that goes by here. Everything you said makes me very happy. So we're reaching the end of the podcast, but I want to put Dave on the spot and ask him, assuming that Donald Trump runs for his third term in 2024, who will his running mate be?
I'll go out on a limb and I'll say it's going to be DeSantis. And yes, there's a there's a constitutional problem there. I think, and DeSantis doesn't really have the option of moving, because at that point he will be the governor of he'll be the governor of Florida. You know, so you can't really ask the sitting governor of Florida to move to a different state. You know, that causes all kinds of problems.
But
you know, nothing stops Trump from moving. I think it'd be interesting if suddenly he pops up as a resident of Texas or something. Something like, you know, who knows?
He won't return to New York, I don't think.
No way.
Both legal and tax reasons.
No way. But I could see him choosing. I mean, you know, the guy's a billionaire. You know, he can choose to live anywhere he wants. So I think that's politically the smartest move he could make. But there are other, you know, outside possibilities. You could see somebody like Youngkin, potentially. You know, definitely won't be Pence. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I think that makes everyone very, very happy.
Yeah, no, Pence burned his bridges. I can understand what he did and how he meant to be. To support the Constitution and support regular order. But, you know, there was nothing stopping him from just saying, hey, I abstain from this because this is just a bridge too far. And you guys can go ahead and install Biden if you wish. And it would move forward exactly as it did. And he could have retained his integrity.
That's an excellent point. He could have gotten exactly what he wanted and still remained a viable candidate. But
correct.
He chose the GOP E tact, which is probably something that no longer will work in America.
Yeah, I think to my mind, and maybe I'm being overly optimistic, you know, which is probably my biggest problem is I think no matter what happens that the establishment wing of the GOP lost. They just don't know it yet. There is no coming back for them.
Okay, I'm going to wrap this up, but Dave, you're going to have to come back because everything you've said makes me extraordinarily happy, and that's a good thing.
Okay.
Anyway, folks, this is the last episode of our first season of Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks. We're going to take a couple of weeks hiatus. As I mentioned, J.J. Sefton is moving off to greener pastures in America and will return in a couple of weeks. And we will talk to you then. Thank you very much for listening. And Dave in Florida, thank you so much for joining us.
It has been my pleasure. Looking forward to the next season.
Fantastic.